Well, as the title implies, and as the hymn we more or less sang said, a fierce unrest stirs at the soul of every living thing. And I want to talk a little bit about that unrest. I had a minor epiphany about the human condition, which is this. We all know that the status quo is unacceptable. Whether you are left, center, or right, the status quo is unacceptable. There are people who want a world that we have never known and never experienced, a world of hope and of peace and of equality. And as RFK, Robert F. Kennedy, said, there are those who look at the world and ask why, and others who dream of a world and ask why not. There are also people who look back with an astigmatism of nostalgia at a sepia-toned, misremembered world and want to go back to that place, to some good old days that probably weren't so good but probably were old and are an old dream. But what both sides agree on is this. The status quo is very unacceptable. The status quo is not working. The status quo is going to lead to disaster, and here's the essential human conflict. And yet, we really don't want to change anything. This creates a little neurotic tension in some human beings, societies, and possibly even the world. We want things to be really different, and just the way I want to eat all the chocolate I want to eat, and I want to lose weight. I want chocolate to have the caloric value of celery. I want to be paid and not work. I want a greener planet, but I don't want to give up anything. I want to have health care, but I really don't want to pay for it, and I don't know anybody who really does. And health care is a good metaphor for this. Look, 11-hour jet lag, I'm telling you, I'm going to be stumbling all over the place. That's why this was one of the most carefully written sermons I've ever prepared. And at some point, if I keep tripping over myself, I'll pick it up and read it to you. That's very unlikely. That's somewhat unlikely. That's really a good idea. Where was I? I know I was somewhere. Healthcare is a metaphor. Everybody understands that it's not working. Everyone understands across the political, philosophical spectrum that you can't keep doubling the prices of health care at a rate far greater than people are increasing their income if they still have income. That's just not a plan that's workable. And yet, across the spectrum, people are afraid of change. It's the nature of the beast. There is a certain calming certainty in knowing that we're driving over a cliff because we know where the cliff is, we know how to do it, and if we change things, well, the cliff might actually show up sooner. It might lead to a better place, but we don't know that. And human beings, conservative, progressive, like the comfort of certainty, even if that certainty is certain failure. We at least feel smart that we predicted it. And that's part of the human condition. Now, the reason that I'm jet-lagged so badly is that I just spent the last 3 weeks on the Death March of Culture through Europe. 11 hours into the future somewhere, I was in St. Petersburg. And that was kind of interesting. And it ties into this not wanting to change. St. Petersburg, the last time I was there, was Leningrad 43 years ago. Before it was Leningrad, it was Petrograd. Before it was Petrograd, it was St. Petersburg. But it had to be changed from St. Petersburg because Saint seemed kind of religious, and Peter wasn't that great if you were a Bolshevik. And so it went to Petra, and then it went to Lenin, and now it's back to St. Petersburg, sounding German and religious all at the same time. It was really interesting to see the difference in 43 years since the last time I had been there. One difference was there were cars, and not just Eastern European cars, but Lexus and Toyotas and Hondas, and there was less air pollution. They had done something industrially to kind of scrub those smokestacks. And they had really done an incredible job of refitting the great monuments, the churches, the museums, putting the gold leaf and gilt and cleaning it up and making it sparkle and shine and beautiful. And it was beautiful. Going to through the Hermitage and through Ekaterinburg and through Peterhof, you see this opulence that is absolutely extraordinary. We had people on our tour who were right-wing conservative people who thought that Dick Cheney was a liberal sellout look around Catherine's Palace and go, you know, I'd become a revolutionary. It was that over the top. Catherine makes Marie Antoinette look like Mother Teresa. I mean, the opulence is just it's beautiful and extraordinary, but you start to feel something terribly out of balance. But whatever name you give the city, whatever name you give the form of government, whether it was under the iron rule of the czars or the Mensheviks or the Bolsheviks or the Stalinists, and now in the new Russia, you have a lot of the same policies, a lot of the same traditions of some xenophobia. They were happy for our dollars, but not necessarily wanting us to talk to any of what we used to call in the Peace Corps the host country nationals. Guides were fonts of misinformation and sometimes disinformation. I, for example, was surprised to find out that there is no anti-Semitism in Russia. This was only a couple of skinheads. There are just a couple of skinheads. It's a rogue element. And when I asked the cantor at the synagogue in St. Petersburg, because after he did his concert, he took off his kippah and put on a New York Yankees baseball cap. Now, that is, in some ways, some progress. Okay, you know, New York Yankees are no longer the symbol of evil to them. Still are to people in Boston, but not to people in St. Petersburg. And I said, can you not wear a kippah outside? He said, oh, I can't wear a kippah outside because I'm not afraid I'm going to be beaten. I know I will be beaten. But that wasn't the most amazing things in terms of three different guides, all with very good English, American English skills. I was surprised to find out that Gorbachev is betrayed the Russian people. And so I pushed on that a little bit, and I said, just betrayed is intentional. Could he have failed the Russian people? Could his policies have not worked out the way he planned and hoped? He said, no, he was a traitor. He sold us out, he made us weak, he broke us up into nationalities and ethnicities, and now we are struggling to get back. I had another guy tell me that Stalin was really misunderstood. He was a pretty good guy and concentrated around the defense, the heroic defense of Leningrad. But my favorite moment was when one of the guides said, you know, you people in the West got it wrong. The gulags were not so bad. Now, you can choose to believe Solzhenitsyn, but the gulags, many people in the gulags said that they had things to read, they were allowed to write, carry on experiments, and it really was pretty good. At this point, I don't know whether to laugh or cry. I am biting my lip, it's bleeding slightly. because I'm trying not to push back hard enough that to get me thrown out. This isn't about Russia uniquely. This is about continuity of policy and tradition that are more important than ideology, that are more important than whether you have a system that is czarist or communist or a kleptocracy or a new Russia. You have a lot of the same traditions and assumptions. Change is something that is more cosmetic in most societies than it is fundamental at the core of who we are. Our beliefs and traditions trump our systems and our laws. And I saw that very clearly there. Then on Monday, this last Monday, we stopped in New York and I went to Ground Zero, where the once proud towers had stood. And I had not been there before. And the great gaping hole in the ground was moving. It was moving in many ways. One, the scope, the size of the destruction, but also the abject failure that that huge hole in the ground represented. It's a metaphor. It's a metaphor not simply for the bringing down of those towers that was American might, some think arrogance, but American engineering and financial might. And today, it's a large hole in the ground that has not been replaced. You can look at the last year and a half and say, well, it hasn't been replaced because the economy is bad, because loans are difficult, but you've got another 4 or 5 years where nothing happened, where despite the bravery, the nobility of ordinary people on 9/11, when 9/11 was over, the greed and the egos and the politics and the avarice got in and blocked anything from happening and from being rebuilt. So it's still a wound and it's still a scar. It's also a sense of the failure of terrorism. Those old ways don't work. It did not bring America to its knees financially or morally. One may argue that some political leadership did their best to do those two things, but it wasn't the terrorists. The terrorism was really futile. There were people tempted to hate. There are people who still carry around things, but that act did not fundamentally change anything except that most Americans now understand that we are not protected and isolated between our shining seas. We are a part of the mainland. Not even Manhattan is an island. No man, no woman, no child, to paraphrase John Donne, is an island. We are all and each across this world part of the same mainland, sharing the same kind of fate. It was also interesting on this trip to celebrate the conspiracies, the 40-year anniversary of our landing on the moon. And there are people who still believe that we didn't, that it was all Photoshop, and to call it Photoshop is itself an anachronism since there was no Photoshop. Their computers on Apollo were abacuses, and it was really a very primitive technology. But there are people that believe it didn't happen. There are people who believe that the World Trade Center's imploded from the inside, that every Jew in New York got a memo not to come to work, that it was done by any kind of organization but not Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda denies that they didn't do it. You got that. And speaking of conspiracies, to round it out, because what this is about is how difficult it is to get through to us about change, about facts, about truth, and get beyond the easy old answers of blame and denial. I wrote a column this week that was published in ink this morning in the Los Angeles Daily News about the birthers, those people who believe that Obama was not born in America, was not born in Hawaii, but was born in Kenya, and therefore is unconstitutionally able to hold the office. Where's the birth certificate? Well, seen the birth certificate. No, you've seen certification of live birth. You haven't seen a birth certificate. There's a big difference, the National Review said this week. We won't even talk about what Lou Dobbs said. And in this well-reasoned article, I pointed out that if the birthers are right, we might as well surrender, because the enemy is just too smart for us. I mean, how counterintuitive would it have been in 1961, where we had barely elected our first Catholic president, to say, you know, if we get a guy who's half African and half Midwestern and sneak him into Hawaii, someday he could be president and we'll control him. Wow, that's really taking the long odds in 1961. But as they say on television, but that's not all, folks. They then had to be smart enough to say, you know, let's really make it tough. And I know in spy school they tell you it should be a white male with a name like Smith or O'Neill or something that is kind of generically American seeming. But let's call him Barack Hussein Obama, and that'll make it easier for him to reach our dream of being this secret Muslim plant in the White House. And this is how smart they have to be. Not only did they manufacture all of this, but they had to put in at least three birth announcements contemporaneously in the Hawaiian papers announcing the birth of Barack Hussein Obama the second. Wow. If they are that smart, if they are that prescient, you know, there's no point in fighting. Let's just give up. This is black helicopter, World Trade Center stuff that isn't about what it seems to be about. It's not about the birth certificate. Most of the politicians who are saying, well, there are questions, we haven't seen it, don't question it. They are cynical. But for the real birthers, the sincere ones, this is code. The code is, he's not one of us. That's what it's about. He's not one of us. And they're right. He's African-American. And they're not. He's Harvard-educated, intelligent, and brilliant. And they're not. So they are absolutely right to believe that he is the other. But the bile. Before my column hit ink, it had 28 comment postings. 26 of them so vile, so violent, so racist that you could just weep. One of our great songs is, when will they ever learn? When will they ever learn? Hatred, fear, xenophobia, anger, paranoia don't work. Refusal to accept a new world, a changed world, where there is at least an attempt, not a realization, but an attempt to deal with virtue as it is lived and as action, as opposed to assuming either virtue or villainy by the amount of melanin in a human being, or a person's ethnicity or religion or tribal affiliation. These tragic traditional distinctions don't work. They don't advance anybody's long-term cause. When will we ever learn? When will we learn to soar? To try to break the thing that has tethered us to past failures and take a leap of faith into a new world, into a different kind of world, into a world where we understand that change is not easy, but we also understand that it is necessary. So I had this epiphany, and I shared it with my wife, the fair Helenkel. I said, I just had an insight, and I think I see the essential conflict in the human condition. We know the status quo is unacceptable, and we don't want to change. And she said, so, will that fix the problem? And I said, well, of course not, honey. She said, then what's the point? And here's the point. Freud was asked if he thought that patients necessarily got better through therapy. And he said no. He said what therapy and a therapeutic insight can do is give you the tools to make changes in your lives. And the insight that we need to change, we must change how we are on the planet, how we are with each other, how we judge the other, how we let those hormones of fight and flight control us, and our fear of change, we have to thoughtfully try to reconcile them. They don't go away in a moment of an epiphany. I am not going to change my life instantly, but understanding the conflict and understanding that the path that we are on needs to be changed gives us some tools that gives us plausible reason for hope and reason to try to improve ourselves and our community and our larger world. We will always have a fierce unrest stirring at our soul. The issue is channeling it into something that builds and elevates instead of cuts down and destroys. Something that says yes to each other and says yes to life.